You're listening to The Gold Standard, Episode 36, Calm Fjord, Inhabiting My Roles and Myself.
Everybody, I'm Brian Levine, and welcome to The Gould Standard, a podcast brought to you by the Glenn Gould Foundation. And we're here once again bringing you conversations with some of the most remarkable people from all across the world of the arts. If film, theater, music, novels, poetry, visual art, and design are like Arendelle, the beloved star that brings light to dark places when all other lights go out, well, you've come to the right place, my friends. And I guess for those in the know, I've now declared myself as a Tolkien fan. Shame upon me. But first, while you're stopping by under our flickering neon piano sign, please do take a moment to press like, share, and subscribe. And if you just so happen to be listening on Apple Podcasts, please kindly leave your reviews, pose your questions, and be part of our community of friends and supporters. While you're at it, be sure to check out our past episodes featuring such luminaries as Petula Clark, Ai Weiwei, Laurie Anderson, Sir Kenneth Branagh, Kat Von D, Cory Doctorow, Barbara Hannigan, and Tatiana Maslany. And to get more simply sumptuous sounds, winsome words, and invigorating images, we'd love you to pay us a visit at our website, glengould.ca. And when you're there, if you just find yourself seized by an irresistible impulse to click the donate button and support the charitable work of the Glenn Gould Foundation, well, that would be absolutely splendid too, and we thank you for it. Our guest today is Colm Fjord, one of Canada's finest actors. We invited Colm not only because of our admiration for his boundless versatility, not only on the stage, but also the large and small screens, but also because this is the year of Glenn Gould at 90, and Colm was the brilliant embodiment of Glenn in the landmark Canadian film 32 Short Films About Glenn Gould, which was shot 30 years ago this year. Colm is one of the most accomplished classical actors alive, a mainstay of Canada's Stratford Festival, but also one of the busiest film and TV actors anywhere. With films like The Insider, Face Off, The Changeling, Chicago, Jack Ryan, Shadow Recruit, Bon Cop, Bad Cop, and for television, he is equally impressive in the starring role in the 2002 Canadian biopic, Trudeau, To the Outer Limits, Boston Public, Due South, La Femme Nikita, West Wing 24, House of Cards, The Borgias, The Good Wife, and most recently, The Umbrella Academy. Colm, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Pleasure.
You're in the new production of Richard III at Stratford, and also this season you're going to be starring in Molière's The Miser. These are productions that actually were supposed to happen a while ago. COVID intervened. What has it been like dusting off productions that were basically getting ready to launch? Do you have a certain sense of deja vu about the whole process?
Well, not about The Miser, because The Miser didn't exist, because it was going to be a late opener. We were waiting to do Richard first. Same director, same cast, essentially. So that's going to be just as much of a surprise as it always was. Richard III, on the other hand, you're absolutely right. It's been a very weird, wait a minute, did we talk about this? Did we do this before? I don't, and was that a good idea? Let's think of something else. So now that we've got to the point where we've actually cut the ribbon, opened the theater and played in front of people, weird as it is, masked and, you know, all of the other protocols, it's been a remarkable journey.
And obviously one that's been accompanied by a lot of frustration and anxiety, of course, you know, along with everything else, worrying about family and friends and loved ones who were at risk during this this terrible pandemic, especially during the more virulent early stages. there's an entire community whose lifeblood depends on the theater, Stratford, Ontario. And it must have been very, very challenging for people you know who are close to you, as well as for you yourself.
Well, you know, most of the folks that I know are two artist households. You know, my wife's a director, a choreographer. Most of my pals are married to actors, dancers, singers, directors, designers. And so it was a very dire time, only because we got it so wrong at the outset. You know, we honestly thought, well, we'll be out for a couple of weeks and this will blow over, maybe a couple of months. And then, and this is where I got it horribly wrong, because we had a crystal ball and we saw how ticket sales were going and the enthusiasm for Chicago, my wife's show, and Richard III at the New Theater, we were convinced that when we could come back, we would certainly be coming back first. And of course, I completely failed to grasp that this particular kind of virus hates the theater. It doesn't want people to gather to rehearse and practice a play or a musical, and it certainly doesn't want 1,850 people to sit around together and watch one. And I just couldn't have been more wrong. And so when that settled in, I have to tell you, there was a period of darkness when I thought, the theater is, as I know it, dead. We can't do this again. And in any discussions I had with folks who were asking me how I felt at the time, I said, well, when and if we come back, it will be with the celebratory sense that, rip your mask off, we're back, and welcome. And to some extent, we've done that. The mask mandates are in place here in Stratford till June, much on the same lines as Broadway and the West End. And fair enough. And I'm so encouraged that so many people are willing to show up and show up masked because they want to see the shows. Now, obviously, we're not masked on stage, but by golly, backstage, we're all masked. The dressers, I congratulated my dresser, Ina, the other day, just simply for being able to cope with dressing me through glasses, a mask, a shield, in the dark, and do up buttons and clips and little hooks in a hurry. With me going, come on, come on, come on, come on, let's go. I'm going to be late, right? Unbelievable things that these folks have managed to accomplish. But we have managed to accomplish them. And so for all the protections and all the testing and all the stuff, we're here and we're sort of open. We're running shows and people are coming. So it's pretty extraordinary.
I can't resist asking whether you've had any wardrobe malfunctions, given the conditions you described, you know, any exposed cod pieces or anything of that nature?
I manage to do my fly up semi-regularly, but I also have a lot of very kind people going, boss, sir, just zip that, and who will help me with all manner of things. We have had a few issues here or there. I mean, you know, obviously playing Richard, it's a busy part. You're running around an awful lot. And, you know, occasionally I have massive capes and trains. We have replicated the Alec Guinness train length, at least.
Oh, my goodness.
From 1953. So that's at least 25 feet of velvet that I'm dragging behind me. And you must understand, I do have issues. Richard III doesn't walk upright and simply swan on. He's got to make his way in his own particular peculiar mobility with this and think at the same time, don't I look fabulous? I'm king now. So yeah, I nearly fell over it yesterday. And I thought, no, that's fine. If I fall over, people will come and desperately want to help me. And I go, no, I don't need help. I may be handicapped, but I don't need help. But it will look pretty catastrophic.
Let's talk a little bit about Richard. Of course, with Richard, you face the challenges that always go with a major part that happens to be a villain as well. And, you know, of course, historically, it's Shakespeare's portrayal is perhaps unjust to the real Richard. What are the special challenges of making a character like that engaging, adding the dimensions, or just living with someone who, let's face it, does some pretty abysmal things in the course of his rise to power?
Well, first of all, we've got Shakespeare's genius. And that changes the landscape completely. You're absolutely right. Thomas More, in service of his boss, Henry VIII, did the real Richard III a terrible disservice because, of course, he was dead and couldn't complain. And so he was vilified as a horrible person and a horrible king. And in fact, he was none of those things. The advantages that I have now in 2022 that I had some of in 2020, I've read the autopsy reports. I've seen the exhumations. I've looked at the bones. I know what he ate, what he drank, why he ate it, why he drank it, and what he was suffering. Quite specifical medical suffering, to which Moore has added, which Shakespeare stole, for dramatic effect. And let us keep in mind that Shakespeare's always looking at dramatic effect. How do I sell a ticket? Yes, how do I please my masters? But how do I sell a ticket? But his genius is such that he refuses to present one of his heroes in what is called a tragedy. And we know from the best Shakespearean tragedies, it usually is about our empathy following the downfall of an heroic character. So how do we make Richard III an heroic character? And this is a bold experiment in a young playwright's canon. He decides to make him a human being. And so for all of the stuff he stole, absolutely verbatim, from Moore, who stole from Holinshed, who stole from whoever, he also lards in the real declension of what happens to a human being who makes a particular choice. And I will bookend this choice. I won't go on at great length because, you know, I want you to buy a ticket and see how it happens. But fundamentally, the impression that the world has of the evil Richard III, which has been, you know, played out from everything from Ian Richardson in the original House of Cards, Spacey pulled a bit of that for his, you know, it's a guy who talks to the audience. Well, keep in mind, this was the first time Shakespeare had ever done that. A character walks out going, I am the title character, and I'm going to talk to you. What? Okay. But more than that, I'm going to express to you my intention. And my intention, given the state of the world, where I'm saying civil war is over, it's been a bad time for all of us, things are getting better, my brother's king, everybody's happy. They're so happy. I'm less happy, and I'll tell you why. Now, I had a wonderful insight to this because I happened upon a thread from somebody at the New Yorker or the New York Times who reached out to Margaret Atwood and was asking her about her work and this, and just like cold called her electronically. And Ms. Atwood is very generous and got back to them and said, I'll talk to you. And she's, this person asked her, what about envy? I mean, you haven't won the Nobel Prize yet. What do you think, Alice Munro? She's like, I know, Alice, that's not how it works here. And she said, you want envy? Forget novelists, Shakespeare. The first lines of Richard III. And I'm reading this thinking, yes, and writing it all down. Yes, you see those people? They're having a really good time. I'm going to wreck that. And I don't know electronic stuff. I don't do social media and all that. But I figured out how to send a message to Ms. Atwood and say, thank you so much. That has cleared up the whole Richard III conundrum for me. I now know how to play it. You see them? Uh-huh. They're happy. I'm going to wreck that. Now, what he does then at the outset is he said, look, everything's great here. Civil War's over. My brother's king. We're cool. And I've got a job. I'm this like right-hand guy. But you know what I can't do? I can't dance. I can't sing. Don't ask me. Love life, zero. Not getting out a lot. So you know what? Since I cannot prove a lover, and this is in plain English, I am determined to prove a villain and hate the idle pleasures of these days. So he says, that's what I'm going to do. And then he goes on to say, this is how I'm going to do it. Now, cut to 2 hours and 40 minutes later, maybe faster if I can go a bit quicker. He's in despair. He's at the end of his, really the end of his rope, and he's been visited by all the ghosts of all the people he's either murdered personally or had murdered to make his life secure. And as Margaret, the evil queen whose son and husband he has personally murdered, says, I curse you, damn you, you're going to, you know, your conscience will gnaw at you. Sooner or later, you're going to wake up and realize you're a horrible waste of skin. Well, that moment comes, And in the speech he has, which I call the bookend to Now is the Winter, he has a dream, a horrible nightmare. All his ghosts come back to see him. And in the course of it, he says, I am a villain. Essentially, and Shakespeare's genius is to repeat much of the language from the first scene in the latter scenes. I hope you guys remember these words because they'll come back to haunt you. But he does it not now as the avatar of the hero Richard, the brilliant king to be, the guy who goes, I don't need to be king. I basically control everything because I'm the smartest guy in the room. And everybody overlooks me because they think I'm not what I am. And then we come around to the human being says, you know, nobody actually loved me. My mom didn't love me much. And you heard her throughout the play say really horrible, hateful things about me. I could damage you, guy. Everybody else seems to hate me. Every time I show up, they spit at me. They call me something new and horrible. And unlike many, you know, Richards that I've seen, I choose to take the hit every time someone says something shitty to me. I go, wow. You know, you just said that out loud, right? You just called me something horrible in public. And you know I'm a prince, right? I could actually have you arrested. But instead I choose to go, okay, I'll take that on. I'll take that on. I'll take that on. I may kill your whole family,
right?
But I'll take it on. So Shakespeare's genius is to provide the hero avatar at the beginning. Let the audience in for a great ride. Don't worry about the boring people. I'll kill all of them. And then say, did you think you could escape your humanity forever?
Right.
No, dude, here it is at the end. And the language is so precise. When finally he says, I'm guilty of all this stuff. I did all this bad stuff. Lady Anne was probably right. If I killed myself, I'd be doing the right thing and I'd be doing a good deed. So I would cancel all my bad deeds by killing myself. Because if I'm going to murder anybody, I should murder me. It's a complicated thought at that hour of the evening, but he then gets much simpler. He finally says, I shall despair. Cardinal sin for a Catholic, which he was. There is no creature loves me. And if I die, no soul will pity me. Shakespeare's a genius with words. He doesn't say, there is nobody loves me. There is no soul loves me. There is no person loves me. There is no creature loves me. We're taking in the whole of beyond humanity into everything else.
Right.
And I think that that's Shakespeare's guidance. That's him directing us toward who he wants the audience to carry out of that theater going, oh yeah, I saw the whole heroic thing. You wanted to be king. You wanted the girl, but you didn't know what to do with the girl. You didn't know what to do with the kingdom. You didn't want to govern. You just wanted to win. And when you won, the instant you won, you lost.
Absolutely. And it's so much richer than just simple villainy. I mean, in some ways, if you compare Richard to, I think, a more traditional villainous character like Iago. I mean, of course, Iago serves a specific function, which is to be an antagonist and drive the plot forward. Richard is the plot. He is the protagonist as well as the antagonist. So it's not exactly comparable, but it is.
Well, it is. It is. Richard was a test case for Iago. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare says a lot, we've cut most of these lines, that Richard says, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that for diverse secret reasons that I don't need to tell you about now. The red herrings. He perfected that with Iago, which I've also played, by suggesting a different motive in almost every scene. Iago says, I'm doing it because of this. I'm doing it because of that. I'm doing it because of that. And by the end, the audience is so confused. And when finally people say to him, why did you do this? What does he say? I will never speak again. I will speak no word. I'm not giving you an answer. And so Shakespeare embraced the ambiguity of the darkness of these characters, knowing, and paradoxically, that they could be very entertaining. They were the most interesting guys. The bad guys are more interesting. They drive the action. They get things going. They open us up to darker elements of ourselves. They tickle us with the, you know, stand-up comedians do this now. Stand-up comedians are the ones who say, you can't say this out loud, but I can because I'm paid to do it. And I'm going to be too dangerous. Oh, but you know what? In the next scene, I'm going to come back and deny I said that because I want to make a different point. Shakespeare, miles ahead of all of us.
Of course, there is the whole physical conception of Richard as an issue. And it's more of an issue, I would suggest, today, because we have, I think, and much to the good, heightened sensitivities about the disability community and, you know, not wanting to create a stock portrayal, or let's say that we ideally don't want to create the idea that Shakespeare is suggesting that people who have a disability are therefore, you know,
inherently evil.
Inherently evil, right. So those kinds of elements of stigma we want to avoid, presumably. But how did you address the issue of the physical Richard?
Well, we have a lot of advantages at the moment, and I absolutely agree with you about current sensitivity to all manner of issues that people have and how that may help or hinder them in terms of an understanding of Richard III. One of the things that limits us in terms of an interpretation of Richard is the given circumstances provided by the playwright. Now, enhanced by the fact that we found the real Richard III's body in a parking lot in Leicester, and the autopsy report is conclusive, not only that it is the real Richard based on Canadian connections and mitochondrial DNA, but what his major problem was. So he had a 60 to 80% curvature of the spine, a kyphosis, a scoliosis, and that is just what he had. Very interesting documentary done recently with a young man named Dominic Smee, who shared very close similarities to Richard's spinal curvature, but also to his physical characteristics, that he's very slight-boned, very slight person, but whose disability was fairly easily disguisable with the change of wardrobe. You know, if you drape things appropriately, you can compensate. So you can go through life without having to announce that you have this particular disability. To that, Shakespeare adds a withered arm, very specifically, and legs of an uneven size. And so the hip is turned in on the left, and the left hand is, left arm is withered. And it's withered in a sense that it's useful, but not terribly useful. And these are the given circumstances we have to address as actors. Now, there are productions of late, some going forward at either the Globe or the ROC this summer, who will have artists with disabilities playing Richard III. And I wish them the very best. Listen, the main issue I have is how hard it is to play the actual part. Never mind what you choose to do as a disability. We were very lucky in having Debbie Patterson come along and help us as an advisor. She is wheelchair bound and has played Richard III and directed and has an enormous amount to say of great use about perceptions. Hers, and in fact, when I talked about that big cape and nearly falling over it, she was very helpful about that. She said, sometimes you want help, but usually people offer you help in the times that you don't need any help. And so you resent that they're offering you help. And then the times when they're not there and you need their help, you think, oh, and occasionally you take advantage. And she was witty, funny, and brilliantly intelligent about how to do that. And Richard does that. He plays with his disability. Does he feel it? Of course he does. And I will go further than that in a minute. But for me, I've had a couple of advantages. First and foremost, I played the part before. I played Richard in 1988. That was, God forbid, 34 years ago when Richard was my age. He'd been dead for 32 years. Needless to say, there's not enough rouge and, you know, extra hair pieces to convince an audience that I'm 32. And I don't do it. I don't even bother. But one of my brothers, John, has sufficiently similar issues that I asked if I could borrow in 1988. And John very graciously agreed. I then reconnected and said, can I use the same stuff? Because that really worked for me. And it is respectful, not only of the author's intention, but now what we know of Richard's actual disability. And the fascinating thing about the documentary with Dominic Smee, there were army, like reenactor, historian guys who said, listen, Richard III historically was a great warrior. How's that possible given what we know? And so they found Dominic and they asked, would he be interested in trying it out? Learning how to ride a horse, fight in battle armor, with staves, with swords, would he do it? And he agreed. And so he did the training. They built him personalized, hand-battered armor by a Dane, I think, Per, somebody brilliant. And they created an armor to suit him exactly. And then they sat him on a horse and they gave him his staves and he ran at various targets and then he ran at various other battle-hardened professionals. And he was amazing. And it turned out, and why a horse, my kingdom for a horse, is so heartbreaking, is that when he was on horseback, the armor and the seat and the saddle supported him to do what he needed to do. This arm was insignificant. It was there. And I have always asked for the design to arm this particular arm that is weak in the most deadly hammered steel possible. So that if he just touches you with that arm, you've got a razor cut across your face. If he leans into you, you're spiked to death, right? So this becomes a weapon. I weaponize whatever handicap anybody might think I have. And then you get awfully good at doing the other thing, which he was good at. And so what happens when you get knocked off the horse, and this is heartbreaking, and there's no time for the play to tell that story, but Shakespeare's truth knew it and needed to tell it. After you get knocked off, you're now carrying the weight of all that armor. As Richard, with no hips, with no nothing to hang it on, you're hanging it all on your shoulders. If your spine is bent in the scoliosis, you think, oh, it's just bent like this. But in fact, it's worse than that in terms of his disability. It's bent. It's also twisted. So now imagine my rib cage is like this. So my ability to breathe is severely limited by the fact that not only am I over this way, I'm pinching my own lungs because of the restrictions of my rib cage. So what happens is, fighting on foot, he only had so much time, right? He could do 20 minutes, a half an hour. He could hack and hew, and obviously he was very good at it, but he needed to get back on a horse. Without a horse, he was lost for all of these reasons. And, you know, at the very end, he says, when Catesby offers him help, he said, look, I don't need help. I bet my life on this. This is my one chance. If I don't get a horse, I know I'm done. And he doesn't get a horse. What does he say when he wakes up from his dream? Not only have mercy, Jesus. The first time he's quoted St. Paul all through the show, but we don't know if he's serious. We know he can mouth the catechism and scripture because it serves him. But if he says that stuff in his sleep, something in his soul and in his conscience believes it. And it's the first thing out of his mouth when he's still asleep. Give me another horse. Bind up my wounds. Have mercy, Jesus. And then he goes into the sad tale of being guilty as hell and not really worthy and being about the only person who can take revenge on himself is himself. And so the audience has all of that complexity to deal with and suddenly realizes, oh yeah, I loved the villain when he was fun. But when he turns out to be a broken, fragile human being, just like me, what can I learn from that? And boy, Shakespeare's good. And this is, you know, not quite juvenilia, but it's young Shakespeare passionately exploring how good he is. And you can feel him going, damn, I'm good. That was really clever. And, you know, I highlight this at various points in the show because I need you to hear the language and have it echo. So sometimes I'll leave a huge pause, not huge. You can tell by the way I talk, I don't leave huge pauses anywhere, but I leave a huge pause after a phrase, like a leitmotif happens, and I say, hear that? Remember those notes? Because I'm in an hour, I'm going to quote those notes, but in a directly ironic way. And you're going to go, oh, Shakespeare. Wow. At least that's my hope.
That is actually, in a strange and interesting way,
a good lead-in to one of the main reasons we wanted to chat with you today. We always like to chat with you. We don't need a main reason, but this is the 30th anniversary of the filming of 32 short films about Glenn Gould, kind of a significant landmark in the early phase of your career. And one of the things in viewing the film again that really struck me was the physicality of your conception of Gould. There's a great deal of dance-like movement at certain places, a certain amount of emulation of the odd postures and what I would call the enraptured but somewhat pretzel-like physical being of Glenn. And I'm wondering how significant getting a representation of the way he bore himself, carried himself, responded with his body to music. How important were those elements to you?
Absolutely essential. I was just looking over my shoulder because on the wall behind me is a poster for Gould that a friend of mine ripped down from a wall in Rome when 32 film brevi su Glenn Gould was playing, when Neve and Don and Francois were all over there flogging it at Venice and Rome. Absolutely essential. And one of the things that I did, I mean, keep in mind, my experience playing Richard in 1988 predates my Gould. So in order to do Richard, I realized that it had to be survivable. And in Stratford, we work in repertory, so I would be playing a different part that night. I would be doing something else again the following afternoon. And so it needed a way of getting in and out of it. And I chose, among, you know, physical conditioning, the Alexander technique. And the Alexander technique is remarkably useful for actors for establishing a neutral place, adopting what you think the character might need, living in that, and, you know, reverse engineering, if you will, the characterization based on what you've got as objective history. In Richard's case, we had all the artwork, we had all sorts of history, not the stuff we have now, thanks to the exhumation, but we had a lot of information. In Gould's case, I went to my Alexander people and I said, okay, there's a piano, there's a stool, and there's a hedgehog. Not unlike Richard, there's a hedgehog playing the piano. I need to be able to find a way to instantly do this, to do it fully and completely with a range of possibilities, and then to undo it to be able to survive it and do the rest of my life. And so what I did was I reverse engineered. I said, look, how does a guy cross his legs on a low chair? And of course, I cut off a chair, which still sits on my front porch comfortably, and I enjoy sitting on it regularly and reminding myself of what we did. I rented a piano. I don't play the piano. I learned the first C major prelude of the Well-Tempered, blah, 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 blah. I could do that. I could also do the C minor ever so slightly, but not to play the piano on film, but to understand the mechanics of some of this. Then I said, so sitting at the piano, curled over, arms up like this, it should be impossible to play well, and yet it wasn't. Find me that shape. And also, he was breathing and humming. So he was living comfortably in this shape. I found that and a lot of variations on it. I then went to François Girard and said, look, it seems to me, because we're doing 32 short films at various stages of his life, I need to offer you a kind of a sound man's slider system where you can do, I want a 3 or a 5 here vocally, a 3 to a 7 physically. And I will do Glenn Gould as honestly and as accurately as I can. And then you tailor it to the material of this particular short film. And so that's what we did, because it was sometimes, as you well know, if I just did Gould as Gould for real, it would be condemned as an improbable fiction. Nobody would believe me, right? So we had to finesse and tailor our Gould to the particular film that we were doing. and enter the historical documents we could find. So, I mean, I saw all the documentaries. I looked at all the photographs. I listened to as many interviews and talked to as many people as I could about what, you know, would be seen to be idiosyncratic movement and behaviors. But finally, you know, it's like the gloves and the hat and the scarves. These are not a costume. These are clothes. They're choices. This is how I feel comfortable. And so what has to go in the reverse engineering is, well, what is it about a person who feels comfortable like this? How is their worldview altered by that? How is their worldview altered by the way they look at the keys and all of that? And so that's what we did to effectively do Gould. There is no consistency from film to film to film to film. It's exactly what Francois ordered on that particular day for that particular film. And I'll tell you why I realized it succeeded and why I've put that into the mix for anything I've done subsequently. I think I did I do Trudeau after that? I think so.
2002.
Yeah, so everything I've learned from Richard and Gould, I put into Trudeau and all these others. And I know it works because of the number of people who came to us, Francois, and I said, oh my gosh, you got him. You got Gould. I mean, listen, I say this in my praise. I'm not trying to be not humble, but it was very heartening and encouraging and obviously gratifying to hear that we'd got him. However, the kicker was nobody ever mentioned the same moment,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
So it was. So I suddenly realized that we were looking at everybody else's perception of Gould. It was their idea of the experience they had with him that colored how they saw him, and we just accidentally got certain stuff right. His dad came to us after the first screening, where he was lucky enough to attend, and we were lucky enough to meet, and said, how did you know about the ice? And Francois and I blanked. We said, what are you talking about? Well, of course, he starts coming in from Oblivion and returns to Oblivion, the St. Lawrence River in January, I'll have to tell you, with me with rubber boots with no socks because nobody thought to buy any. Never mind. With a radio in my pocket going, go left, go right, go back. Waiting for a freighter to come across the horizon as it did like that, because it was 100 miles away, and I stood out in the cold waiting for Francois to think that the vision was sufficiently clear. Ugh, I suffered for my art. But how did you know about the ice? Well, what are you talking about? That was just a good idea we had. He said, no, one of Glenn's favorite things was to grab the dog at Lake Simcoe. I just walk out under the ice and disappear forever and come back and reappear magically. So, you know, one felt at moments like that, the skin tingle and the spirits were speaking to us.
It's really interesting, though, that, and tell me if this is kind of a standard element of your methodology, because I had a very interesting conversation about a year ago with the Canadian actor Tatiana Maslany, who has, you know, played, I think it was 13 different characters in the same show, Orphan Black. And she said one of the great aids was working out the makeup, the hair, the wardrobe, because that basically helped me to solidify my conception of who they were inside of that carapace, that shell. So does that sort of working from the outside in, is that something that you do as kind of a standard methodology? Is it often helpful?
I've been very lucky in that my evolution was at a repertory company. So I've always played three or four or sometimes five different characters in a season and sometimes different characters in a show, you know? So like Tatiana, our experience of the costume, the hair, the makeup. Martha Henry, God rest her, would always choose a scent, a nail varnish, particular to a particular character. So that when you got into that world, every layer you added helped your imaginative work to convince yourself, because of course you're the first one that needs convincing, that you are who you say you are. And so Yes, I find that stuff enormously useful because my background is my studies involve mask work, commedia dell'arte work, classic mask work. And so you stand in front of a mirror with a character mask and you work with a shape that you've observed in the world. You're stealing from the world. My wife keeps saying to me every time we're on holiday, stop looking at people like that. It's weird. And I said, it's a job. It's the only reason we can afford a holiday. She doesn't buy that, but that's neither here nor there. But I find people fascinating, and I'm always stealing a little piece, a walk, a tick, a twitch, a something that I think they have to live with that. What would I do? Who would I be if I had to live with that? How would that help? What would it say? But, and you start this imaginative work. Now, yes, it's superficial, right? But here's the thing. You do that enough. You create that shape consistently and honestly. And, you know, now they're finding the gut changes the brain. Well, the body changes the brain. The body changes the heart. The body changes the feelings that you have as you move through space. Because if you adopt something purely accidentally, you just say, I'm going to do this, then your moving through space is going to be different than your normal moving through space. It's going to speak to you. It's going to make you feel a particular way. Now, that's going to trigger an emotional response. If you can use that emotional response as a learning opportunity to inform the lines that, if you're lucky, have been written by a genius, then now you've got the dovetailing of a visually convincing exterior, the emotional connectivity you have having been inspired by the experience of that physical dimension, whatever it may be. It could be something as simple as a slight stiffness, a slight upper lipness, a kind of who knows what arrogance that you face the world with, which changes how your voice is produced. Because as I said about Richard, if I do that, it changes where my lungs sit. So it changes how I can speak, not just how I do speak. So when you start to add all that together and you add the critical factor of the imaginative work that the actor must do, either in a mirror with the mask of makeup, hair, costume, in our case, occasionally mask work, and I will go back to classical mask work because it was the most inspiring stuff of my studies at the National Theater School of Montreal. I also happen to be graced with extraordinary teachers, Perry Schneiderman, Pierre Lefebvre, people who knew this stuff from their days at Le Coq, their days around the world, teaching masks to the finest actors that have ever lived. And so I learned early on the value of that and never demeaned it as technical or a superimposition on the experience of the true beauty of my exploration. And I have a theory about this as far as Canadian actors go. And my theory is that for those of us who have the good fortune to work in the big spaces in Canada, you know, the Shaws, the Stratfords, the Soul Peppers, and every big regional theater beyond, you were given opportunities to do big plays, important plays. But we do them, let's face it, based on the foundations of a British tradition of the theater. That's where we came from. Chris Plummer, whom alas we lost too soon, was one of the great living examples of that. But at the same time, someone who worked with and embraced that emerging American method stuff that was so compelling, that was undeniably watchable in its De Niro and Pacino-esque work. And we thought, hang on a minute. I want to be real like that. I want to be honest. I want to be spontaneous and available. But I want to be able to do it again tomorrow night at 8:00. And I want to be able to do take 35, slightly different, but founded on the same thing. So how do I do that? And so it seems to me that we as Canadian actors have the very best of the English foundation of tradition and respect for technique and skills, but with a rather romantic attachment to being passionately there in a moment of raw, I don't know what's going to happen next, so you can't possibly either. And
I think we've succeeded at this. And I think it's a wonderful, happy balance. There are some dark moments when the passion of the moment makes the Shakespeare leave my head. And I think, I really believe that. That was truly honest and rich and in the moment. I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to say next or who I am. But I'm willing to take those risks now at my age, because why not? And, you know, I have to say our cast of Richard III is lousy with artists of that ilk. Shauna McKenna, Lucy Peacock, Diana LeBlanc, Wayne Bess, Ben Carlson, Michael Blake, Andre Sills. We've just got an absolute cornucopia of fabulous people, the young people, Kasim Khan and Emilio Vieira. We've just got all these extraordinary people working together. But the old gang, between us, we have about 550 years of experience with Shakespeare on these stages. So we can be, we hope, helpful in sharing how we do this here with these, you know, this new generation. And that is, you know, it's equally useful in television and film. I think in the theater, we have a little bit more time. Tatiana obviously had a series to work it out. We don't have as much resources. We don't have quite as much time, but the ideas are exactly the same.
Well, there's so much I want to talk with you about Stratford specifically, about Shakespeare and classical theater, and also your film and TV experience. But I don't want to let go of 32 short films just yet, because it really was something of a landmark. It was, I think, a moment that led internationally to Canadian film being, at least English language Canadian film being seen in a different light. I know that it had a very significant impact on the course of your own career. When you were first approached, I mean, first of all, how did you get the role? And the idea of playing a deceased classical pianist, I mean, what was your reaction to something like that? I mean, had you been very familiar with Gould? Had you, you know, listened to his recordings? Or was it a relatively fresh encounter when you approached the role?
Well, interesting you should mention how old it is. My neighbor brought me over the New Yorker magazine from 2 weeks ago. And in the recommended Anthony Lane section was, you must see 32 short films about Glenn Gould. It's a remarkable film. That was 2 weeks ago. So that's enormously gratifying. I had heard, obviously, the recordings. My parents had the recordings. I had kicked my speaker system with the 1980 Goldbergs, going, what's wrong with this? What's that sound I can't get rid of? It took me forever to figure it out. But now, of course, it's the chief thing I listen to. What did I think about being asked? Well, I wasn't asked to play it. I was asked to audition for it. And Niamh Fischman, the producer, Don McKellar, and François Girard came to Stratford. They'd auditioned all kinds of people and were continuing to audition all kinds of people, friends of mine. And they came to see a production of Romeo and Juliet in which I was playing Mercutio. As it happens, Anthony Cimolino, the artistic director, now directing Richard III, was playing Romeo, Megan Follows was Juliet, and I was Mercutio. And so they were coming down to see me on stage, which was peculiar, for a film thing. I thought, well, all right. And then they wanted to meet. I said, well, Mercutio dies halfway through. I won't do the curtain call. We'll go for dinner. But I decided to out-Herod Herod. And I spent some considerable time studying Gould before dinner and arrived at dinner essentially as Gould. I have a propensity to large fuzzy sweaters and coziness. I don't like being cold. We share that. And I just, you know, there were certain mannerisms and things that I thought I could lay on. And it was clear, because they'd come to the classical theater and were looking at other classical actors, that they needed something, someone who could accommodate the complexity of their script, because their text was very interesting in its construction. And it required, dare I say it, a kind of flexibility in the acting that first and foremost required a certain amount of skill at articulating English, which doesn't hurt in terms of Gould, and classical acting is a good place to find those people. But then the physical, you know, manifestations of Gould would also require an artist trained in a particular way, I thought, and one who could be encouraged to find Gould. And so then I auditioned and I auditioned and I auditioned, and it was painstaking and tedious. And Francois, and you know, he kills me for saying this, but you know, he wasn't by any means convinced immediately that I should be it. And you know, so I had to jump through a lot of hoops. This involved driving to Toronto, lying down under pianos at the Royal Conservatory, listening to music on cassettes with Francois and pretending that I understood what he meant, dressing up as Glenn Gould in gloves and a rain jacket and a cap, wandering around the lake in Stratford and agreeing to improvise being interviewed by him as Glenn Gould. I mean, there was a lot. But Francois was just one of those guys. And on one of my ventures into Toronto for this, you know, terribly lengthy audition process, uncharacteristically for CBC Radio 2, at that hour of the day, on came Petula Clark singing Downtown. And I thought, I might actually get this. This is a sign. And so when I did, obviously I'd done an enormous amount of work. Then I hired the Alexander people, I cut the legs off chairs, and I proceeded in earnest to do what I was doing. Keep in mind, I was still doing Stratford. So at some points, my wife Donna was there on set saying, no, he's got to be in a car. He's got a show in a couple of hours in Stratford. So you guys have to hurry up. And we were going to shoot on Mondays, my day off. And then after the season ended, we were going to shoot like for 1 week in a row. It was crazy. And, you know, it was done for pennies. But it did change the landscape. Certainly, it helped me enormously. But it was also a very interesting way to do a biography. It wasn't just A, B, C. It was, listen, we can't presume to know this guy in a 1, 2, 3 ABC kind of way, but we believe these points on the compass might be telling in an understanding of who he might be. And we won't necessarily be conclusive about any of it, but it'll give you some thought. It might make you listen to the music differently, and it will certainly give you a new appreciation of the man himself. And I think it did all of those things and helped all of our careers immensely.
And I have to say that the structure, the, you know, series of almost kaleidoscopic vignettes really serves the subject matter well, because first of all, Gould is a complex and multidimensional personality with many contradictory aspects, but also it helps to avoid one of the great pitfalls of biographical films generally, and especially classical music films. We talked a little bit about this with Don and Francois, that you know, they're among the worst films ever made, composer biographies. And one of the problems is that they're just so cloyingly sentimental, and 32 Short Films really isn't. So I think that it really still holds up extremely well. But were you surprised at the reception, at the number of people who saw it? I mean, you know, within a few years of the film being released, you're working with, you know, directors like Sidney Lumet, for example. It's
But Sidney saw it. Uh-huh. Sidney saw it. It's how I got in the door with Sidney. It's how I got in the door with people like Robert Redford, who explained to me, although they didn't give me the job, finally, because I was there as a gambit so that Sam Neill could get more money. I didn't understand these things as a youth, but now I do, and I forgive them all. But sitting down with Robert Redford, the first thing he said to me was, I need to explain to you why I programmed 32 short films about Glenn Gould 3 times at Sundance when it first came out, because I love this, I love that. And Sidney was amazing. And there I was with, you know, Milos Forman, and Sidney saying, oh, because I'd left Sidney's set to go see an audition for Milos Forman for something, and he wanted to talk about it. And so I was absolutely bouleversé, as they say, about its reception. And so when it finally came out on VHS, I went to Los Angeles and gave up my career in Stratford, such as it was, to venture into film, because Francois persuaded me that it might be an interesting idea. He said, you know, you should do more film. And I said, well, what do I need to do that? I'm happy to. He said, well, you need to be available. And I said, well, you know, because available is code for unemployed. And I had obligations. I had children and ex-wives. I had, you know, all manner of things that needed looking after. And I said, well, how long do I need to be available? And he said, 2 years. I said, Francois, I can't do that. I can't be unemployed for 2 years. Stratford has been very, very good to me. And, you know, I leave here with great trepidation. But something emboldened me, and I did. And I brought these VHS tapes. I got in to see Sydney. He gave me a job. John Woo gave me a job doing Face-Off.
Face-Off, right.
You know, all kinds of people gave me jobs based on this art film. And so I'm doing blockbuster films based on an art film, thinking, what? And I would go in and move to meetings in L.A., and I learned very early on never to ask questions. People would say to me, oh, I have 32 short films about Glenn Gould. I have it on Laserdisc. And sometimes when I was foolish and young, I'd say, oh, which one did you like best? Oh, love them all. And I realized I'd never seen it. Their secretary had seen it, told them it was really cool. And they had a copy on the desk because that was a cool thing. They'd never seen it. I have a copy of it on Laserdisc that I bought on Sunset Boulevard one day. Ask me if I have a Laserdisc player.
No one has a Laserdisc.
Or any other Laserdiscs.
No one has a Laserdisc.
It's sitting on the back of my bookshelf, hopefully garnering eBay cash value as we speak. But it's never been out of the package. Because, you know, I realized that word of mouth was not a bad thing to have, right? Nobody needs to see it. But they need to think, oh, I hear it was cool. And that the people who did it were cool. And maybe we should see them. And that has served me very, very well. And then in retrospect, we went to TIFF. I think it was Don and me and Francois and Neve and a bunch of others, and saw a print 25 years later. You may have been there. And it was wonderful. I mean, the fact that it was on film and you could see that and that it held up beautifully as a film. I don't think there's anything about it to age it or date it, if you will. It's just the story we set out to tell about Glenn Gould, the best we could tell it at that time. So I'm immensely proud of it.
And of course, Canada is immensely proud of you, because one of the things that you have accomplished is a kind of a magical act of having a fully engaged classical theatrical career, and not just classical theater, but contemporary theater too, but also, you know, one of the busiest careers in Hollywood, and very different careers, because, you know, in the sense that a lot of your film and television work is what we would call the character parts, which are often the most interesting parts, the parts that have, you know, non-traditional personality traits that make them stand out and provide the sort of the frisson that allows the film to be remembered after the fact. But also a remarkable career in television, series television. And I think about all the different series that you've done, you know, 24 and House of Cards and so on and so forth. How have you managed it? I also want to talk about one of my favorites, which is The Borgias, because it is so opulent and so splendid. And you must have felt very jealous because you were the only one who didn't get to wear gorgeous costumes most of the time because you were a cardinal.
The boy who should be Pope. Had they gone to a fourth season, I would have repainted the Sistine Chapel. I would have been Julius II, and all would have been right with the world. But, you know, one of my favorite things is doing these kinds of parts that either nobody expects. I mean, people talk to me about shows I'm in and recommend them to me. Oh, you should see this. It's very good. And then occasionally I say, oh, yes, I know. I've seen that. I'm in it. I did this and I did that. No, you didn't. No, you didn't. And I'm always delighted with that. Or when there's great reviews, Stephen King tweeted, and I worked for Stephen King years and years and years ago, but he tweeted about a performance I did for a thing called For All Mankind, which is a series for Apple, where I play Dr. Werner von Braun. And, you know, with a great wig fancy from Stratford here that my pal Jerry Altenberg cobbles together. And these are thrilling things to do because there's a challenge to it. You think, oh, I can't get away with this. At the same time, while I'm doing the Umbrella Academy for Netflix, at the same time, while I'm doing something else and contemplating doing the theater. But of course, in order to make a living as a Canadian actor, you have to do that. You know, we have to be flexible. And I suspect, I mean, really, it's been my dream. I have no desire to be famous. I wouldn't mind trying on rich for size. That I could try. But famous, no, except insofar as it would sell another ticket to a play. And I always thought that that was part of the reason I would leave Stratford and garner a bigger audience doing blockbusters, Thor and House of Cards and whatever, that those people might go, oh, I just saw him on TV. Maybe we can go and see him in the theater, you know?
Well, actually, you mentioned one of the experiences that I wanted to chat briefly about, and that is finding your way from things that are more intimate and a little bit more personal and a little bit more small scale to Thor, the Marvel Universe. And also, I think you were in one of the Spider-Man films. When you're in that kind of production where you're literally surrounded by an army, where the world around you is a green screen, where in the case of Thor, you are look like underneath about 198 pounds of, you know, prosthetics and makeup as Laufey. What is that experience like? And also, it struck me in Thor, and maybe this was because it was Kenneth Branagh directing it, that the Asgardian world was very Shakespearean and was set in direct contrast, an intentional contrast to the, is it New Mexico world where the humans are inhabited?
You're absolutely right. And keep in mind, if the Thor universe is run by Sir Kenneth, it's going to be run like a classical theater company. He's going to know everybody's name. He's going to know everybody's wives and children's names. He's going to marshal the hundreds of millions of dollars of resources responsibly and effectively, but he's going to direct with Shakespeare as a shorthand. And keep in mind, I'm standing next to Tony Hopkins. I've spent 6 months in Rome being Tony Hopkins' little brother in Julie Taymor's Titus. So we've got enormous layers of experience together doing large, dramatic, and sometimes ridiculous things. And I've always said, if you need, you know, large, ridiculous things done, you need classical actors, because we can make almost anything sound important. And Kenny was directing Tony with quotes from Lear. I need more of this from Lear. He'd look at me and say, Winter's Tale, you know, act two, scene two, the jealousy, the this, that. What about that? Can we have more of that? Because, of course, he's needing a shorthand because we don't have any time. We don't have any more money. We're shooting on film, which was glorious, and surrounded, as you said, by an army. So there's a reason why actors like me are hired to do these things, I think, and who can withstand 5.5 hours of prosthetic makeup, red eyes and bad teeth, because we're reliable. And we're reliable in understanding the poetic heightened quality of the heroic genre that is those kinds of pieces, right? We don't find this stuff ridiculous, because we've been saying ridiculous stuff since we were born, right?
Right.
Right? So we are used to that heightened poetic language as just people talking. And so that, I think, teaches us something about the value of that kind of world. Marvel is not very far removed from Shakespeare. In fact, I would suggest respectfully that it is a contemporary version of. Ken spent 2 years improving the script to make it more Shakespearean, to make it more solidly recognizable as, look, these are the stakes. This is the family stakes. These are the lovers' stakes. This is the world survival stakes. And, you know, he was very funny about how he got the job. He said, I'm sure this is a mistake. It's a complete accident. Because, of course, the guys up at Marvel headquarters saying, this is a really classic show. Thor is classic. It's like Norwegian mythology, dude. This is classic stuff. It's classical. Who should we get to direct? I don't know. It's classic. Who's that classical actor, director guy? Ken Branagh. He's got classic all over him. And he says, I'm sure it was that simple. But he beat it into an heroic shape that respected every single character down the list. So, you know, it makes a peculiar kind of sense that it's all of us there.
Right.
Look, I did Chronicles of Riddick. Chronicles of Riddick. What am I doing standing next to Linus Roach, Carl Urban, and Tandy Newton, and Judi Dench, for crying out loud? Well, because management realized the people we need to say this stuff like it's convincing are these folks.
And of course, as you said, you've gone from everyone has to be thoroughly prepared, well-disciplined, show up on time, know their lines, because you were in productions where there's no money, to a production where you have to do the same thing because there's so much money, but also so much cost that every second on the meter is costing, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I assume that you also experienced the famous Marvel veil of secrecy that around everything to do with the films.
They would do my makeup. You know, I show up at 3 a.m. Everybody else is coming in at 9. They do my makeup. Kenneth was very gracious. He said, I'll never call you in and not use you. So you will always be doing something. So we come in, we do all this in the dark, in secret, and then I have to go across to the next studio to shoot. They put me in a bag. They put me in a golf cart. They drape the golf cart with black sheeting and drive the 8 feet to the next door. I said, what is the problem here? Who are you hiding from? To which, with all seriousness, they said, helicopters. I said, nobody is going to be in a helicopter taking a photograph of a big blue guy before his time. They said, you don't know anything. Get in the van. So I get in the van. We do that. We go over, shrouded in this, shrouded in that. Then we finish the day. Keep in mind, it's endless. And now I need 2 hours to get out of it. And as I'm getting out of it, and it comes apart in sheets, but, you know, large recognizable bits, they are instantly shredded by a goo shredding device, lest that anyone should go to the dump and find bits of Laufey that might be pieced together to sit. Now, there's already, you know, a bande dessinée. There's already a cartoon, a magazine, right? The graphic novels are out there. The comic books are out there. People know what it's going to look like. No, no. They are as serious as a heart attack, and one can only respect them for it. I'm on board.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, we're coming close to time, but I wanted to end with a couple more questions that take us back to Stratford, but using another television experience as a stepping stone, because it is actually one of my personal favorite TV series of all time, and that is Slings and Arrows, which is in many ways the creme de la creme de la creme of all Canadian acting and writing and directorial talent. So many great people involved. And I have to say that the thing that I love about the series is, of course, it's witheringly satirical about an institution that we know and love and the tendencies and trends that tend to blow us off the course of why art matters, business and commerce and trends and, you know, fads and all the rest of it. But also there are those moments of enlightenment where you know, and it's usually around a great soliloquy in which everything, the sort of the clouds part and this magical moment of inspiration is conveyed. And, you know, Paul Gross did a wonderful job. Bill Hutt did a wonderful job. But I have to say that you as Sanjay were hilariously funny. Often you don't get to play comic parts, but I've never seen anything that made me want to roll on the floor so much, having lived through this kind of thinking. So can you talk a little bit about the series and also the character that you played?
Well, I feel very guilty about Sanjay retrospectively, because there is actually an actor out there, Sanjay, who is a colleague. We've worked together. And when the script came along, they said, what do you think? And I think they had other ideas for me. But I said, I will do it if you let me play Sanjay. Now, I understand that they then went back to Sanjay and said, look, change of plans. It turns out Colm wants to be you because it would be more ridiculous or whatever. And I just responded to it. And with, you know, Mark McKinney and Bob Martin, and the writing and Susan, it was just, an extraordinary opportunity. And as you say, not something I'd be offered. It would be easy for me to play one of the Shakespeare characters, right? Be straightforward enough, and I suppose I could have done that. But at that point in my life, I wasn't interested in that. I was interested in the hilarity and the, you know, the way they were taking the piss out of Stratford, claiming that they were never taking the piss out of Stratford. Stephen Wimette, the fool to my Lear and a genius actor, trying honestly with a straight face to claim he wasn't channeling Richard Burnett. Now, yes, he can't do that. And it's no disrespect to Richard's memory that he was simply channeling Richard, because the idea of an artistic director walking out of a bar here and being hit by a park truck is just too possible. It's just too possible. And it was heartbreaking, and heartbreaking for all of the right reasons, particularly because Stephen was a friend and knew how to deliver this up. And I thought, for me, this was a part where it's about credibility and acting. You just need to believe you are who you say you are, and you are, right? And I always tell my kids, what do you do, Daddy, for a living? I lie for money. I convince myself that something I know is patently untrue is true. And that is an exercise, is what we constantly need to be reminded of as actors. And so for me to be part of that series and to know that it was such a huge success, I get noticed, recognized for that in America.
Right, exactly.
Way more than in Canada.
Well, the thing about it is, you know, Sanjay is the head of a cutting edge marketing company.
And Froghammer.
Froghammer, right. And the and the desperate folks at the New Burbage Festival come to him to say, we need to reinvigorate our messaging. And they end up with something not quite what they expect. Anyone who hasn't seen it, you will love it. You should get it. It's not a terribly long series. It's available, I assume, for streaming, definitely still on DVD. But it takes us back to Stratford, you know, a place that you started in, I think, 1981, that is literally your home now, but is, I think, a unique institution, certainly in all of North America, possibly in the world, as a, you know, surviving classical repertory company that also does contemporary theater and musicals and so on, but has kept true to its mission where Shakespeare is concerned, and has built a truly extraordinary institution with, you know, so much memory and so much capacity to nurture young talent and so on, and a theater, a physical theater, the festival, that I think is also in many ways unique in the world.
Quite right.
So I don't know where to begin, except to ask you to expatiate a little bit on, you know, starting off with John Hirsch, for example, and how the special opportunities and challenges of the festival theater, at least as it was, and the new theater that you're opening in the new Tom Patterson. I'm going to shut up and let you just say what you'd like to say about Stratford.
I've been very, very fortunate to have grown up here and been, you know, guided by the John Hirsches, the Michael Langhams, the Robin Phillipses, the David Williams, Richard Manettes, you name it, of this Johnny Nevilles. I've worked for every artistic director except for Tony Guthrie, who may have been dead before I started acting. And the advantage to that is that I respect the space. I realize what it can give me as an actor, how it's trained me to work in the movies, which is sounds paradoxical, but is in fact true. Because you're out on a thrust stage, you are three-dimensionally available to your audience. You're acting the moment you leave your dressing room. If you're not, it's too late. And so you're also conscious of the opportunity you have as an actor for control and power. It's an enormously enlivening experience to say, once the curtain goes up, and in the festival and at the Tom Patterson, there is no curtain, we just start. I have absolute control of the quality of the evening. And I tell you when it's going to be the wide shot. I tell you when it's the medium, and I tell you when it's the close-up. I tell you everything I need to tell you. So I have control of your experience, vocally, physically, emotionally. And that is hugely gratifying as an actor, because you say, I'm here to play Shakespeare's music. I am nothing but a cipher in this experience for you. But in order to be the best cipher I can be, I have trained hard, physically, vocally, emotionally, to play this music every day in a different way, every night more live than the last, responding to the peculiarities of this particular house of people, but not just in a picture perfect proscenium arch way, but in a fully three-dimensional, 360 way, where John Hirsch, who trained me first with this, said you have to have your intention radiating out of the back of your head because you are such a cheap, you bought your grandmother the worst seat in the house way back there, and if she doesn't have a fine experience, you will not live for tomorrow's matinee. And realizing that there was that technical element of our responsibility trained me up very early. And I was in four shows on the main stage my first year, and we had no equity rules that stopped us from doing more. I did 12 shows a week, and I understudied Richard Manette in a fifth show at the Avon that nobody would have let me out of the other four shows to go do, but they still paid me to do it. Ludicrous, but it was a mad time, as you may remember, and John had come over to save the day. And those of us young and green enough to be here benefited enormously. And so that's how I was trained. And that's where my love of the place developed and where my understanding of what it takes to work here. The Tom Patterson now, when I first went to the TPT, it was the third stage, and it was Michael Langham, under John Hirsch's direction, saying, take these idiots and train them how to use our stage. We've had them here for 2 years. They're useless. They need to be better. We need them to be trained up properly. You started the theater after Guthrie. Please figure out how to make these people better. So we were sent there, a handful of us, and then new people came, etc. But we were there to learn how to use the main stage. So that space was an experimental space. Michael thought we can't charge more than $10 a ticket to have these people learn how to act. And we were all graduates of university programs, of conservatory programs, of 2 years on the main stage. We were experienced, most of us, but still very young, very green. And so Langham took us in hand, and then we were sent back to show what we knew. And so that kind of cross-pollination is how I developed. Now, the new TPT in this beautiful architectural incarnation, we have an opportunity to do something more than merely train to use the main stage. We can perform in an intimate, acoustically brilliant space that now, and I keep saying this, and it's not just because I'm talking to you. My doing Richard III 34 years later, I liken to Gould doing the Goldberg Variations in 55 and in 1980. The differences are striking. It's still the same music. It's still the same notes, but played in a much more informed, mature, and reflective way. And this space is the instrument that allows for that. So, for example, the decibel level in silence at the festival is about 24, 25 decibels, which dictates how I send the thoughts out. The decibel level at the Tom Patterson Theater is 12.
Oh, my God. It's
staggering.
Pin drop.
And I can speak as quietly and as I'm speaking to you now, and everyone can hear it. So it allows for a potential of interpretation that I relish at my advanced age. It's not that I use less energy, it's that I use it in a different way. And so I look forward to exploring that as we learn how to play this magical new Tom Patterson Theater instrument.
Fantastic. Colm, you've been very generous with your time. I know that we could go on and on. I hope that we'll have a part two at some future date, because I want to ask you about Lear and Hamlet and, you know,
excellent,
Romeo, and how the physical design of a theater, to go into more detail, can actually shape the mise-en-scene of a production, and again, returning to the festival, and so many other things. But for now, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time and wish you every success with this Richard and with the Miser. And I hope that everyone listening to this podcast will have a chance to see it. And given that this will be available for years to come, that every other production that Colm is in, that you rush out, get those tickets and get your bums in the seats. Thank you so much, Colm.
Thanks so much for having me. Take care.
And that brings to a conclusion our conversation with the one and only Colm Feore. And it was really enlightening to get his insights on developing a challenging role like Richard III and dealing with the physicality as well as the inner state of a great theatrical villain, as well as his experiences in preparing for and playing Glenn Gould and the stepping stone that it represented in his career. It really was excellent. And of course, whatever Colm does, and you can see him just about everywhere, it's always interesting. And often, even when he is in supporting roles, he really, really is the person that your eye is drawn to on the screen because he just has such a presence. Anyway, our wonderful producer, Rudra Priya, now has some vital and indispensable information that she would like to share with you.
The Glenn Gould Foundation is a registered Canadian charity, and we rely on the support of arts lovers like you to continue bringing inspiring stories to life. Please consider giving by visiting our website, glenngould.ca. And if you're interested in keeping up with the Gold Standard podcast and more work from the foundation, be sure to follow us across social media on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at the Glenn Gould Foundation.
And friends, please be sure to join us for our next episode when we continue the Gould Standard tradition of bringing you stimulating conversations with some of the most interesting and challenging, creative, exciting, and thought-provoking figures from all across the world of the arts. Don't miss an episode. Thanks so much for being with us.